So good evening. Thank you for having me here. My name is Michael. I live in Canada, which is your sister country. For the last 10 years, I've run a center in Toronto that was called Center of Gravity. And the aim of Center of Gravity was to articulate secular version of the Buddha's teaching, bridging two streams in the Buddhist tradition, the Vipassana stream, which I was trained in, the insight stream, and also Zen practice, which is also my other favorite practice. And so we were trying to bridge a Dharma practice with the core teachings of contemporary yoga, because I felt that as the yoga community was growing, people wanted to go deeper into the embodied practice of yoga, but probably in a commercial yoga center, they wouldn't have that opportunity, in the same way that many people wanted to go deeper in Buddhist studies, but joining a temple or going to a monastery wasn't interesting or even possible for them. Or they had been through that process, as I had, and wanted to try something else. And also, my academic training was in psychoanalysis, so I was also interested in how to articulate these teachings in contemporary psychological terms. And lastly, my interest is how all of these practices can be put to work in our busy, urban, beautiful, and problematic lives. So I ran this center. It started in a garage, actually, and eventually grew to quite a large community. And then just over a year ago, I decided that we had a wonderful 10-year run, and I wanted to do something else. So I closed the center. Stephen Batchelor, who many of you know, who's a close friend of mine, he said to me a few years ago, he said, you know what would be really interesting is what if you put a clock on your website and it counted down and you had an expiry date for your community? Some of you who know Stephen, you understand what he was getting at. But I thought this was a great idea, so that's what we did. We had a countdown, and it was 1 year, and then it stopped. And part of the reason is because I feel like there are some primary issues that Dharma practice needs to address, so that it's not a passing fashion in our culture. And I think those issues are economic inequality, climate change, and the atrophy of intimacy in our own hearts, in our relationships, and the degradation of intimacy in our community, which is really, I think, the loss of democracy. Oh, an alarm. So, I decided to leave the center to spend more time thinking through how this would be possible and trying to articulate a vision of how this is possible. So this is basically what I would like to share with you tonight. As I mentioned to some people earlier who asked me about other things I'm doing in London, this is kind of a two-part talk. Tomorrow night I'm giving a talk at a place called Yoga Campus in Islington. So I hope tonight that I can explore with you a little bit in terms of how Dharma practice can heal us internally, but also how it can be put to work in our culture. Because I think we have to exit this binary thinking where one has to do inner work in order to do outer work. I think this is not necessary. So if that's okay, that's what I'm going to speak about. The title of the talk originally was Embodying Our Values, because Louise says, what do you want to talk about? And I just have to say as vague as possible what I think I'm going to talk about in several months. What I actually want to talk about tonight does have a new title, which is Why Can't the Tail Pass Through? And what I'd like to do, if you're confused, is unpack a koan from the Zen tradition. So in the Zen tradition, there are parables that are given to students once they have some calmness in their mind. It's exactly the same as in insight meditation practice. When once a student starts to get calm, we start to give them questions to explore so they can look more closely at impermanence or the emptiness of self. So in Zen practice, it's very, very similar. Let me describe this koan to you. And the way you work with a koan is when you hear the koan, you just notice what about it snags you. And then you let that into your whole body. So maybe it's one word or maybe it's a sentence. So let me read you the koan and then hopefully we can unpack it. And I'll speak for less than an hour, I hope, and then we can have a short break. And then we can meet back and hopefully debate together. So this comes from a text called The Gateless Gate. It's case 38, if you want to look it up tonight when you go home. Wu Zhu said, it's just like a water buffalo trying to pass through a window. Can you see it? It's just like a water buffalo trying to pass through a window. Her head and horns and four legs have all passed through. Why can't the tail pass through? Can you picture this? Water buffalo comes through a window, and everything passes through. The horns, the head, big body, all four legs. But the tail, which on a water buffalo, some of you might know, is actually very small, it can't pass through. Why can't the tail pass through? And so if you want to unpack this koan, you need to explore this question. Is why can't the tail pass through? So, whenever there's a koan, there's always the case, which I've just read. Then there's a commentary on it, and then there's a verse. So I'll read you those before I offer my own interpretation. Wu Men says about this, if in regard to this question you're able to turn around with it and express yourself, then you will be able to repay your debts and help others. If you're unable to do this, then keep reflecting again and again on the tail. Then you'll be able to grasp it. Here is the verse. If it squeezes through, it will fall into a ditch. If it squirms back, it will be stuck forever. This itty-bitty tail, wonderful. So picture, there's this window, and then there's a ditch on the other side. So if the tail can get through, it'll fall into a ditch. But if it's stuck there, it'll be stuck forever. And then he says, how wonderful. So he's giving you a clue, saying the tail can't get through. Why can't it get through? So, the water buffalo. For those of you who have been studying Dharma practice solely in the Theravada tradition or insight tradition, usually there aren't these absurd stories like this. Mostly you get lists. You know, the six of these, the eight of these. And when the Dharma went to China, they started to undo this practice of focusing on lists, and they started to focus more on dialogue between people. And conversation, which is, interestingly enough, I think, if you read through the Pali Canon, the most interesting parts are actually all the dialogue, not the lists, really. The lists are helpful, but the dialogue is the best. So, what is this water buffalo? The Buddha often used local metaphors And in India and also in China, a water buffalo was the most utilitarian household implement, if you will. Water buffalo is like a bicycle in London or a pickup truck in Texas. You need it to get around, and it makes it easier to get around. You can get your hay and you can get your food and so on. And so it's very interesting to make a water buffalo stand for the mind. Because the mind is also a little bit like a bicycle or a pickup truck, isn't it? Where on the one hand, you can make it serviceable, and on the other hand, we never really know what it is, right? And animals are like this, aren't they? You never know what an animal is deep down. And I think our mind is like this also. One of the things that happens when we sit still and we feel our breathing is you start to feel your life. You feel how your body carries so much of the past. This is very interesting. Alarm system. That's okay. You see how your body carries so much of the past. And then also sometimes you sit, and that's not true, where your body actually doesn't carry the past. And you have moments where you don't feel the weight of your scars or your gender or your age or your health even. It has nothing to do sometimes with your embodied experience of the moment. But sometimes we need to stop and feel what our life is like. And when you feel what your life is like, you feel your past, you feel the present. And sometimes we notice that repetitive thoughts have in them old stories that we replay again and again and again. The divorce, someone you've lost, a job you've lost, old loves that have ended. But actually, from the perspective of a meditator, when you really look at the past, or you look at what your body carries, or you look at the habits of your mind, you don't really understand. We think we understand, don't we? We think if I just have another good story, I'll be able to finally get to the, you know, as though you're an archaeologist, you know. This is the fantasy sometimes, I think, of psychoanalysis, where if you just get to that root story, it'll undo your symptoms in the present. Well, actually, the truth is, when you look closely at your life, it's a total mystery and you have no idea. Isn't this true? I mean, we really have no idea. I have a friend, and her relationship just ended. And she emailed me saying, we just split up. And I said to her, you have no idea what happened. It's nobody's fault. And she says, what do you mean? You know, and she gave me like paragraph after paragraph of everything. And I said, yeah, everything you're saying is completely accurate, and you have no idea. And there's nothing you can do in your practice to end the mystery of your life. And the same is true with other people. The more we know other people, the more we have no idea. I always suggest to people who live with somebody, a wonderful practice is when you wake up in the morning, if you still sleep in the same bed, look over at them and just go, huh? And in a way, a water buffalo is like this. We think we might know a lot about a water buffalo. The context of this koan is that this was a time where the ox, which is the same as a water buffalo, was really prized as a metaphor in religious literature. Some of you might know, for example, the ox herding pictures, which was very famous at the time. So in a way, the ox is being poked at, saying, you think you know what it is, but you don't know what it is. Can you feel this? And in a way, what happens, the more we practice, the more we think we know what's going on in the practice, but really we're being fooled by that. And so when you're on this side of the window, everybody can see that your practice is beneficial. People around you, if you're sincere and devoted in your practice, people will say, oh, you know, you're becoming a kinder person. You're not as freaked out about everything. Or, you know, if you do MBSR, you don't have any stress and you eat raisins, you know, very slowly and so on. But maybe also over time, you're able to forgive. And maybe when people speak, you can listen with a little bit more depth. And your life actually looks like it's getting better, because the head got through and the tail is still there, though. And to you, you know that even though it seems like all these other things are happening, you're more generous, you have a deeper understanding, something can't get through. And I think sometimes we have this feeling that the tail should get through. And so if you change the emphasis of this question, why can't the tail get through, from why can't the tail get through to why can't the tail get through, then maybe we start to see that the tail can't get through because the tail's not supposed to get through. There's a wonderful text called the Vegetable Root Sutra. That was translated only once into English by a guy named Kaz Tanahashi. And in it, it says, water that is too clear has no fish. Therefore, you should always keep a measure of grime in your practice. So in a way, the tail is not just grime. And the tail does not stand for, you know, the Jungian shadow or something like that. The tail stands for the fact that there is something in our experience that at bottom is unknowable. And it doesn't get through. And I think all of us have to pay attention sometimes to the fantasy that we've gotten through or we can get through. This idea of nirvana as being free from all kinds of craving. So, why can't the tail get through? You know, we're living at a time where the tail is not just personal. It's also cultural. It's also social. There's a wonderful term in economic and environmental circles called climate debt, which is recognizing that northern industrial countries got a 200-year head start on pollution. And so we also need to take a head start. We need to take a lead on recognizing that the people who are really paying for the effects of our industry are not entirely in our hemisphere. And so we have a debt to pay. We have a tail. And it's easy to not pay attention to the tail. It's easy to not pay attention to the tail. So one of the interesting things about climate change is that it's like a diamond. When you look closely at any one part of a diamond, you start to see that it has numerous sides, infinite sides. And climate change is a little bit like this. If you look closely at climate change, just as a beacon these days, you start to see that it has in it every other social, psychological, economic problem that we all face. In other words, if our economic, social, psychological troubles are all interconnected, then the solutions are also all interconnected. And this is also part of looking at the tail. Most of us are waiting around for some big new idea. Have you noticed this? what's the next big idea? But we're living at a time where we don't need a new big idea. We don't need any more ideology. What we actually need are to pay attention to the smaller ideas. We don't need a revolution. We actually need a rebellion. And the rebellion needs to be embodied. Because every revolution, and we've seen this for the last couple of centuries, always replaces one power structure with a new power structure. If we look at Egypt and we look at Cuba, it's not that inspiring. So what we need to be able to do is find a way to resist institutional forms of violence. We need to resist the way we've internalized them. And we need to do so in an embodied way, so that we're modeling our practice, we're modeling our values, we're embodying our values in everything that we do. It's really easy to talk about. So I'm going to keep talking about it. So I think that there are really three things that we can do in the face of these issues. The first is we need to learn how to stop. We need to be able to stop. Most of us, just in our own hearts, we're running, 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 and we can't stop. So just to be able to stop, in meditation practice we call this shamatha, which comes from the root sham. There it is again. I love that. Which means to calm. And the stopping has two sides. So on the one hand, we need to be able to stop internally, which is something that I think everybody here is exploring in their own, hopefully, daily practice. But we also need to stop cooperating with systems whose values are not in line with the values that we're also exploring more and more deeply as we continue to stop. So the stopping has two sides. Is that part clear? Yeah. That's the first thing I think we need to do, is to be able to stop. The second thing we need is we need a practice. Because you can't really stop without a practice. I think all of us have the experience of, you know, reading a wonderful book about the present moment, and then you put it down and you're neurotic again. We need a practice, and I don't think it matters if your practice is a meditation practice or an art practice, but there's some kind of practice that you engage in every day. And one of the things that's different about meditation practice than making art or making music or dance or something, and I think this actually might be the most important aspect of meditation that I think doesn't get articulated very much, is that when you have a daily meditation practice, it doesn't produce anything. I mean, yes, we advertise it as helping with your blood pressure and so on, but you don't actually get anything. Like when writing is a practice, you have something at the end. But when you practice meditation, you don't get anything. And I think there's something profound about that experience. So we need a practice. We need to stop. We need a practice. The third thing is that we need to tell new stories. I think the most radical thing that anybody can do in a culture is to tell the stories that are not being told. One of the fascinating things about meditation practice is that when you follow your breathing and you start to calm your mind, you create a clearing or a space in your body, in your mind, so that new thoughts can arise. I think sometimes in meditation circles, we have this language that you know, you're calming your mind and getting so concentrated, and then you just aren't going to think anymore, you know. If that was the goal of practice, you could just inject Thorazine or whatever and be done very quickly. But the interesting thing that happens in meditation, which I also think is very similar in psychotherapy, is that we hit a point where we're completely sick of our stories. I remember this experience early on when I was doing longer retreats, just seeing how all of my thoughts were about me. And even when you go to sleep at night and you dream, you're always the main character. So, this is addiction, right? The inability to stop telling the same story again and again and again. And also, it's not your fault. Most of these stories are not even your stories. You've just learned them. Right? So in a way, mindfulness practice is about being vigilant with these stories. To be able to see stories and let them go and create a space for new stories to emerge. And that space in Mahayana Buddhism is called your Buddha nature. And so I always think your Buddha nature is your capacity for imagination. Because imagination is the opposite of repetition. Imagination is the opposite of compulsion. So we need to stop, we need to practice, and we need to tell new stories. And the stories don't even have to come from you. Because actually they're already being told in the culture, they're just being told in the margins of the culture. And that's what I mean when I say we don't need a whole new ideology about how we're going to deal with climate change or a new economic model, because it's already being done. We just have to see where the stories are being told that are not the big stories. And I think real change is going to happen when we start linking up smaller stories and smaller actions in a network. And the thing about linking up networks is they don't have a leader who's a white guy, and you can't put them in jail. You can't stop them, which we've seen time and time again. So, what does this have to do with the water buffalo? We practice every day. We wake up in the morning and we sit. This is my life anyways. I'm a dad, and our youngest son, we still sleeps in the bed with us. Do people do that in London? I don't know.
Yes.
Okay, anyways.
In London, people do.
Okay. So anyways, my practice is, as soon as I start waking up, I really quietly roll over and sit on my cushion. Because if I walk out of the room, the kid wakes up. So, and every day I sit and I follow my breathing. Sometimes I sit for 30 minutes, sometimes for longer. And whatever shows up in that space, I practice breathing with it and being close to it, being intimate with what's showing up. Boredom, jealousy, envy, greed, happiness, peace. And what my practice consists of is being able to make contact with what I'm feeling and simultaneously not to hold on to it. And when you can sit every day for a short period of time and take care of your capacity for greed and your capacity for anger and your capacity for confusion, then you don't act out those energies as easily in the culture. And that's why meditation practice is a form of social action. Because you're not acting out those seeds in your family and in your mind and in your body and in the body politic. Also, when we're not paying attention and we're distracted, it's very easy for corporations to sell us stuff. When you're content, you make choices that are nourishing. When you're distracted, you make choices that go after false forms of nourishment. We all know this. Right? So maybe mindfulness is actually a political tool. Because when you're focused, then you're embodying your awareness. And you can make skillful choices without holding on to them. You can try new things. You're more connected to your imagination. And hopefully, you're modeling this practice for other people. You know, we're obsessed these days with teaching meditation to kids. You know, but actually, we just need to model this for young people. That's the most important piece. At the end of the day, we don't know how to deal with these huge issues. Climate change. Inequality. And what I'm hoping is that through practice, we can be more comfortable in this space of not knowing, or what we sometimes call beginner's mind. And when we're in this space of not knowing, we might be surprised that some of the solutions are actually right there, right in front of us. We've just been looking in the wrong spot. It's like when someone comes to psychotherapy and they say to the therapist, "I'm so sick of telling this version of myself." That's usually the moment when something new can open. We all need to tell a new story about our life. And I think the Dharma offers a really interesting story. Not the whole thing. It can't offer the whole thing. It's not a theory of everything. But it can offer a set of tools, or what Stephen Batchelor calls tasks, which I like very much, that we can undertake in order to internalize our values. So they're not just philosophy, like, you know, I adhere to nonviolence or something, but that you become nonviolence, that you become honesty, that you become peace. It's not just a philosophy of life. So, the horns get through, the head gets through, the body gets through, but the itty bitty tail, why can't the tail get through? So, there's some part of our life that's just unknowable. And the more you practice, the more you can be comfortable in that space. And there's an interesting moment in the commentary on this. I'll just read it again. If you're able to turn around with this one and express yourself, you will be able to repay your debts and help others. Isn't that beautiful? If you're still unable to do this, keep reflecting again and again on the tale, and then you'll be able to grasp it for the first time. In other words, if you keep paying attention to the tale, then you can repay your debts. But it's hard for us to look at the tale because we're so confident in what we know. So, let's sum up. There are three issues that I hope we will include in the realm of our practice. Climate change, economic inequality, and the degradation of intimacy. I think we're seeing these issues not just in the culture, but we see them in ourselves also. We see them playing out in our families. We see them playing out in how we think. And there are three things we can do. Number one, we can stop. Number two, we need a practice. And number three, we need to tell new stories. If you take away anything from tonight, I hope these are three areas that you can start to look at in your own life and in your own practice. So I'm going to pause here because I feel like I've said a lot. And then maybe we can have just a very short break, and then we can have a discussion. And then my bedtime is 9 p.m., so hopefully I'll be in bed at that time.